I'm Mike Webb, and welcome to the ProPublica podcast. This week, Daphna Linzer continued her investigation of the presidential pardon system with a devastating report about an African-American man named Clarence Aaron. Linzer will share his story with you shortly, but her reporting shows how approvals for clemency have dwindled. Presidents Reagan and Clinton approved roughly 1 in 100. President George W. Bush approved 1 in 1,000. And President Obama, he's approved only 1 in 5,000. Her previous work showed how white criminals were nearly four times as likely to receive a presidential pardon than people of color. Linzer is an award-winning journalist who wrote the first report that ProPublica ever published. She came to us after a stint as a national security reporter for the Washington Post, and before that, as a foreign correspondent for the Associated Press. Thanks for joining us, Daphna.
Thanks, Mike.
All right, so tell us a little bit about Aaron and what crime did he commit?
Clarence Aaron is a today 43-year-old man living in federal prison, but once he was a 23-year-old college football star. He was a linebacker at Southern University and had never had a run-in with the law, was a terrific student and student-athlete, and made a big mistake.
He introduced
two friends, a college classmate whose brother had a reputation as a drug supplier in Texas, to an old high school friend of his who was dealing drugs in Mobile, Alabama. The high school friend had basically run out of a supply line and turned to people he knew, wondering, is there anyone out there who could help me? And Clarence did help him. Months later, what was then quite an active drug ring in Mobile, Alabama, was busted. Conspiracy charges were offered in court, and numerous people were rounded up, including Clarence Aaron, who was indicted while he was still in college in Baton Rouge. Clarence turned himself in. The case went to court. And Clarence, remarkably, though not the buyer, the dealer, the supplier, or the user of the drugs, received the stiffest sentence of all.
Do you know why?
You know, this
is
actually...
Did he not cooperate?
Yeah, you know, there's a few good explanations here. One is he refused to turn informant. Much of the prosecutor strategy in prosecuting the drug wars, and remember, this was 1993. This was sort of the height of the drug war as it was being prosecuted by the Justice Department. Much of that prosecutorial strategy relied on conspiracy, relied on members of a conspiracy informing on one another. Clarence Aaron, for two reasons. One, because he had claimed to know so little, just was not really a member of the drug ring, was not a dealer, was not involved, had almost actually nothing to bargain with. He just knew the least of all the people in the conspiracy and didn't want to rat out friends, frankly.
Because that's the code of the kids.
Right, and because it's so destructive in general to communities, as it has been. So he didn't cooperate with prosecutors. He pleaded not guilty and so went to trial. And because he refused to acknowledge his participation, because he refused to inform, and because he refused to plead guilty, he received a mandatory minimum based on the amount of drugs that were sold. Clarence Aaron received a triple life sentence without parole at the age of 23. No other person convicted in this conspiracy received any sentence anywhere near that. In fact, only Clarence and the drug supplier today remain in prison. The drug supplier is scheduled to be released in a year and a half.
But not Aaron. And the judge sentenced him.
This was a mandatory minimum, so the prosecutor really was the one who established the sentence. Clarence became a symbol of the excesses of the drug war. In 1999, he was featured in a Frontline documentary called Snitch. And this documentary really was about people like Clarence Aaron, people who ended up getting the stiffest sentences because they knew the least.
Right.
He was one of those.
So what he served time 20 years and whatever. What process did he go through to try and remedy this?
So after the Frontline documentary came out, he garnered enormous support suddenly for his cause. A representative, a congressman, a Republican congressman from Alabama, Sonny Callahan, supported his application for clemency, a commutation.
When is this? Give me a time frame.
So this is in late 2000. This is just as the Clinton administration is leaving, and President Clinton is pardoning and issuing commutations on his way out of office. There were lots. They were getting tons of publicity. Clarence Aaron threw his hat in the ring very, very late in the last days, really, of the Clinton administration, and it was way too late. That clemency application was not reviewed by the Clinton White House, and it sat at the pardons office as President Bush was inaugurated and came in. And then over the next couple of years, the pardons office started to examine his case.
So did President Bush change the pardon or clemency process when he came in?
You know, not so much, except that unlike President Clinton, he was not open to examining applications that were sent directly to him. He kind of left it all in the hands of the pardons office. He was spooked, frankly.
By what happened with Mark Rich?
Exactly, by the scandals left in the wake of President Clinton's mass pardoning at the end of his presidency. And so President Bush was trying very hard to sort of protect himself from politicizing pardons and commutations. What happened was that so many people who were seeking relief just were at the mercy not of the president, but of the pardon attorney.
So what happened with Aaron's application?
So Aaron's application started to go through the regular process. And at this time, in the early 2000s, it was kind of going through a regular process. The pardons office was gathering information about Clarence Aaron. They sought the opinion of the sentencing judge and the prosecutors, which are basically two very heavily weighted voices, either in favor or against an applicant. In Aaron's case, at this point in time, the sentencing judge took no position. He didn't want to get involved. He wrote a letter back to the pardons office saying, I just don't feel it's my place to comment on this case. The prosecutor opposed. The prosecutor said, Aaron made choices. Aaron chose not to cooperate. Aaron was involved. That's how we see it. And we don't believe that his sentence should be commuted at this time. So the pardons office actually wrote a denial recommendation. And frankly, I interviewed the pardon attorney at the time who told me that they wrote it with a heavy heart.
Explain.
They said, he said to me at the time, the man who was the pardon attorney then, he said, it's very, very hard. Clarence Aaron is a tough case. It's hard to look at this case and not see a young man, not sentenced to life, but sentenced to death.
So Aaron's case came back up again. Did he reapply?
It's interesting. In some ways, there was a little bit of serendipity here for Clarence Aaron because pardons eventually in the Bush administration kind of fell into disarray. Recommendations were piling up. The White House kept looking for positive recommendations, but the pardons office was only sending negatives. And so when they received the denial recommendation, they actually didn't act on it. President Bush didn't sign it. It sat at the White House gathering dust with hundreds more denial recommendations for 3 years.
So that strikes me as very strange because it sounded like they wanted to try and approve some of these.
Absolutely.
What's going on?
So actually, the first part of our series in 2006 and 2007, we showed through internal emails that we obtained, documents and interviews, a lot of frustration in the Bush White House, both by numerous White House counsels who wanted to find meritorious candidates both for pardons and for commutations of sentence so they could get out of prison early. You know, we showed times in which Bush's White House counsel went to the Justice Department, asked for more favorable recommendations, and were repeatedly frustrated by the Pardons Office refusal to find good candidates. Their seeming insistence on saying no to thousands and thousands of applicants. At the end of the Bush administration, sort of the end of 2007, as they were heading into their final year, basically, lawyers in the White House counsel's office just started picking through the denials themselves, hoping they could find some good cases. One lawyer found that of Clarence Aaron and pulled it out.
Okay. And so then what happened next? It was re-reviewed?
Right. They sent it back to the Justice Department and said, this guy looks like a good case. This is the kind of case we are looking for. This guy has been in prison for 14 years. He has incredible congressional support and support from civil rights organizations. Please go back to the judge and the prosecutor's office and see if they can change their minds.
And was there a specific prosecutor who shepherded, who did the investigation?
Yes, there was a couple lawyers inside the pardons office who then went out and handled the interviews. And remarkably, as the White House had hoped, the sentencing judge for the first time changed his mind and was willing to voice his opinion and came out in full support of a commutation for Clarence Aaron, said that he thinks the president should commute his sentence immediately, that he served too much time. And frankly, this is a judge who was appointed by Ronald Reagan. This is a Republican appointed judge who also came out on the record really talking about his disappointment in harsh drug sentences, that they didn't work, that they were not deterrents, and that Clarence Aaron's sentence was excessive.
Wow. And what about the prosecutor in the case?
Right. So this was the last leg of the work here. And there was a new prosecutor in Alabama, also a Republican appointee, a Republican appointee appointed by President Bush. She was a sentencing expert, and she pulled the case off the shelf in her office and went through it on her own. She spent a week examining it and wrote, you know, a lengthy, thorough, well-thought-out memo, 5 pages, to the pardon attorney, Ron Rogers. It begins with an opening sentence that says she supports commutation for Clarence Aaron. She goes through some of the mitigating circumstances, and she offers a suggestion that he be have a sentence commuted immediately to the equivalent of a 25-year sentence. And then with time for good behavior, and Clarence is a model inmate, he should be released by 2014, the same year as the drug supplier. That was a suggestion, but more importantly, her opening statement in the memo and her closing statement was that Clarence Aaron needed to be commuted.
Okay, now Rogers was the person who reviewed this and passed it on to the White House?
Right. I mean, I think that the sense inside the pardons office for line attorneys working on the case was this was an extraordinary moment. We got a document showing a lawyer inside the office writing a memo to his boss saying, wow, you know, in light of the support now for Clarence Aaron, both from the judge and the prosecutor, I guess we're going to recommend favorable. Would you like me to type that up? The pardon attorney, Ron Rogers, responds, thanks, I'll take it from here. Instead of doing that, he goes in the absolute opposite direction.
What do you mean?
No new recommendation. He sends the old recommendation for a denial right back to the White House with an email. Interesting, I don't know the answer. Instead, he sends an email saying, no changes here. The new prosecutor, you know, her opinion largely dovetails that of the old prosecutor. The judge doesn't oppose.
That's not correct.
Right. I mean, he really left out key information that would have swung the case in Aaron's favor. What was remarkable was when we took those original opinions, both the document from the prosecutor and the notes from the judge, back to the White House counsel, the associate White House counsel for President Bush, who shepherded Aaron's case, he was aghast. This was completely not what he had understood to be the case from Ron Rogers' email. Again, you know, with a very heavy heart, said he would have recommended that President Bush commute Aaron's sentence. you know, I just want to say it was so extraordinary. And, you know, I had to call Clarence Aaron in prison and tell him, you could have been out 4 years ago.
What was his reaction?
You know, he is quite an extraordinary character. I was impressed by his grace. There are times when you think it'd be pretty easy for a guy in his situation to be quite angry.
I would think I would have flown off the handle.
Yeah, he didn't. His immediate reaction was that he was overwhelmed that he had had that support. He didn't know that the sentencing judge and the prosecutor had been in his corner for so many years. He was truly moved. And he said, you know, for those whose support I haven't won over, and of course he was referring to Ron Rogers, he said, I'm determined to work so hard until I win him over.
That's incredible. Now, you also wrote about a guy named Reed Pryor. What's his story?
Yeah, Reed Pryor is one of 12 people in the last 12 years who did have their sentences commuted. In fact, his sentence was commuted on December 23rd, 2008, the same day that Clarence Aaron was denied. Reed Pryor was a four-time drug offender in Iowa. He was not 23 when he committed his major drug offense that got him a mandatory minimum life sentence. In fact, he was in his 40s. He was already a serious drug addict and a very significant dealer of methamphetamines. This was a guy who kind of had all the breaks. He's from a middle-class family, grew up in Des Moines. His parents were educators. Their friends are judges and lawyers. You know, one of them knew the wife of the governor. He went to the University of Colorado and Grinnell College. But drugs devastated him.
So he applied for clemency and got it?
Yeah, he did.
And do you know why? Were you ever able to find out the basis for his approval?
Absolutely. The pardon office actually was not really interested in Reed Pryor either. At first, they rejected his request for clemency. But his lawyers went right to the White House instead. They used every connection they could come up with. They were savvy and got a meeting with Bush's last White House counsel, Fred Fielding, just weeks before Bush left office. That ability to walk in the door and make your case to the lawyer of the decider.
It made all the difference.
It made all the difference. And it actually, 1 week after that meeting, Reed Pryor had his sentence commuted. And you know, he lives today. You know, he's writing a memoir. He's not in prison anymore. And that was, you know, the same day that, you know, Clarence Aaron was denied. So it was really, really a remarkable, stark difference, especially because, you know, Reed Pryor was a significant repeat offender. Reed Pryor did not have the support of the U.S. Attorney in Des Moines, just the opposite. You know, he kind of had everything going against him. Clarence Aaron had everything going for him, you know, and ultimately Reed Pryor, who's, you know, white and middle class, you know, was able to jump every single hurdle.
So what's the status with Clarence Aaron right now? Where do things stand?
Clarence Aaron turned 43 last week and celebrated his birthday in Talladega, Alabama, That's right, a medium security facility. And, you know, visited with his mom on Mother's Day and relatives who drove from Mobile to see him. You know, he in many ways has been fortunate because his case has always garnered a lot of attention. But I think, you know, there's going to be a renewed effort now to try and see his clemency case through successfully. He reapplied in April 2010. The Pardons Office has been sitting on his application for 2 years.
Were you ever able to get a sense of why Obama has been reluctant to grant commutations or pardons?
Yeah, I think this has been a vexing question for people generally. In some sense, I think on pardons, Obama has pardoned so few people because the pardons office has given him so few recommendations. Like Bush, he's been reluctant to go outside of the system, thinking that it would be that the system is really working for him. I think that our stories show that it isn't. I think our stories show that it isn't working for him and it isn't working for applicants. So I think that he pardoned a few people because there weren't that many good recommendations. After our story came out, I think that they became very suspect of the recommendations in general. On commutations, it's sort of the same thing. Our reporting shows that the pardon office is denying applicants en masse, just writing down hundreds of names of applicants and putting a note on, you know, a note attached saying these people are not good candidates.
Does that come from the top down?
You know, you would think, but the pardons office, because it supports the president's only unfettered constitutional power, has really kind of operated without any oversight for a very long time. And the pardon attorney, I think, just has the sense that he's protecting the president by saying no to all of these applicants. You know, I'm not sure that that's exactly the way the White House would see it. Would they know of all the information?
Okay. Let me close this out by asking you, why is this a ProPublica story?
Oh, I think this story goes to the heart of so many things that we care about. You know, when we first started to take on the Office of the Pardon Attorney, the question we asked was not about fairness or justice or individuals. It was about whether this constitutional power of the president's was being well served. This is, you know, this is something the founding fathers fought for in the Constitution. They saw it as a fail-safe in a justice system that's fallible. And so that was the number one thing. Then when we started to discover this race disparity, and we're talking about a race disparity that is, you know, possibly one of the greatest race disparities in this country in the 21st century, and we found it at the heart of the Justice Department. So for that reason alone, this is a ProPublica story. And because when people in this country go into a courtroom, when they rub up against the justice system, they need to believe that they are being treated fairly and equally. And if that's not the case, then something needs to change.
Daphna, it's a great story and you did a great job. Thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you, Mike.
You can read her investigation at ProPublica.org/commutations, and you can see all of her work in our pardon section. And now for our official Say the Darndest Things Tumblr quote of the week. I didn't know if I was staying in a 5-star hotel or a 2-star hotel. Who said it? Representative Bill Owens, explaining where he and his wife stayed during a 4-day trip to Taiwan. His room averaged $520 per night. As we reported, lobbyists for Taiwan coordinated the $22,000 trip, despite House rules prohibiting members from taking trips arranged by lobbyists. After our story was published, Owen said he would reimburse a Taiwan university for the cost. Thank you for listening to the podcast. For ProPublica, I'm Mike Webb. We'll catch you next time.